WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, film director Meera Nair. Her new movie is an adaptation of Jhumpa Lahiri's novel, The Namesake. Nair says the story reflects her upbringing as well as Lahiri's. The movie is set in Calcutta, where Nair grew up, and New York, where she now lives. Nair's previous films include Vanity Fair, Monsoon Wedding, and Mississippi Masala. The Shangri-Las were one of the greatest girl groups of the 60s, with hits like Remember, Walkin' in the Sand, and Leader of the Pack. The lead singer, Mary Weiss, dropped out of music when the group split up in the late 60s. She's just returned with her first solo album. We'll talk with her about her life then and now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Meera Nair, is a film director who grew up in India and has made several films about India and Indians in America, including Salaam Bombay, Mississippi Masala, and Monsoon Wedding. She also made the adaptation of the Thackeray classic Vanity Fair. Nair's new movie, The Namesake, is adapted from the best-selling novel by the Pulitzer Prize-winning Indian-American writer Jhumpa Lahiri. The film is about a man and woman who enter an arranged marriage in Calcutta and then move to New York and raise two children. The children grow up immersed in American pop culture and American values about love and sex, so there's a lot that the parents and children don't understand about each other's lives. The son is named Gogol, after the Russian author, but the name is so unusual it's always been a source of embarrassment for him, and he's never understood why his father chose it until this scene, when his father explains how the name relates to a train crash he survived before he was married.
It was 1974. I was a student in Calcutta. Every year I would take the train to visit my grandfather in Jamshedpur. I carried one book with me to read on the journey.
Gogol?
Yes. The overcoat. So on the train, late at night, Mr. Ghosh befriended me. And he kept trying to persuade me to leave India. And I just wanted to get back to my book. My grandfather always says that is what books are for, to travel without moving an inch. And that's when it happened. I kept hearing Ghosh's voice in my head.
Pack a pillow and blanket. See the world. You will never regret it.
That is how I came to America, and you got your name.
Meera Nair, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Namesake is about many things, but you've described it as being about the death of a parent in a foreign country. And of all the things that happen in the movie, I'm wondering why that's such a defining moment for you.
I guess it was it's what inspired me to make this beautiful novel into a film. It was inspired by grief and melancholy. I read this novel by chance on a plane in a period when I was in abject mourning for losing my mother-in-law, who died of medical malpractice in a New York hospital, kind of unexpectedly. And in our custom, we bury almost the next day, and sort of found ourselves burying her in a freaky snowstorm in New Jersey. And it was in my first, experience of the finality of death and loss like that. And all the more tough because I never expected it at all. And I read The Namesake purely by chance on a plane, 6 weeks after this. I was just absolutely captured by the distillation of Jhumpa's writing, of especially the death of a parent. And I felt like I had found solace. I had found a person in the world who understood exactly what I was feeling. So that was the first kind of recognition, or the first feeling of this fever that I had to make this novel into a film. But then on rereading and rethinking before the plane even landed, it was that and more than that.
When you optioned The Namesake, you knew how you resonated with certain experiences in the book. But did you want to also learn about the author's experiences more directly? Did you talk with her directly and meet members of her family?
Well, I knew Jhumpa a little bit from Interpreter of Maladies. She had talked to me about the possibility of directing one of the short stories, and we knew each other very briefly. But of course, as soon as I came back to the States, I met with her and told her, more than asking her what her experience was, I told her my vision of The Namesake as a film, which really made her, to use her word, ecstatic. And only after that, after she gave me the book, which was within a week of my reading it, it seemed, only when I was deeply entrenched in it, I insisted that I spend a weekend with her family, her parents in Rhode Island, who are, in Jhumpa's own admission, sort of she channeled, especially her mother, to write the character of Ashima, the mother in The Namesake. And I loved Mr. and Mrs. Lahiri. You know, they became like my own uncle and aunt, kind of. And meeting them and even being in their home was a great model for how I wanted this film to look and feel. And the first thing I made Tabu and Irfan Khan, the actors who play Ashok and Ashima, do when they came to the States months later to shoot this film, was to spend a day with the Lahiris. And that was a key for them to understand how to interpret the character.
Tell me something that you got from spending time with Jhumpa Lahiri's parents.
You know, the feeling of her father, who is a librarian and a very self-effacing man, deeply intellectual, deeply erudite, but completely as if, you know, a quiet presence, never someone to assert himself or to make himself heard, but by his own kind of contentment and the love in him, you know, you gravitate towards him. He's strongly sure of who he is and doesn't need to brandish anything about himself. And that was a very important quality that Irfan had to adopt for to play the role of Ashok. Her mother is a lot like as she is described in the book as Ashima, also someone who's incredibly cultured, very knowledgeable about Bengali movies and about movies in general, about songs, about... I talked with her a lot. You know, for instance, even the lullabies that I had Ashima sing in the film are all lullabies that Mrs. Lahiri sings to her grandchildren. I wanted to make the film as personal to the Lahiri family as Monsoon Wedding was to my family.
Now, in the movie The Namesake and in the novel as well, the parents in the story have an arranged marriage. And although their relationship is pretty formal with each other by a lot of American standards, and they're not given to emotional displays, they are very deeply in love. And falling and staying in love is actually much more difficult for their son, who was born in America and grew up in America, and relationships for him are much less permanent, even when he thinks they're going to be permanent. Now, you made a movie about an arranged marriage, Monsoon Wedding, and I'm wondering if your views on arranged marriages have changed over the years.
Well, you know, I'm very intrigued by arranged marriage. I'm not a candidate for arranged marriage myself. I've never had an arranged marriage. But my brothers have, for instance, and, you know, people very close to me have had very, very successful arranged marriages. Oftentimes, if one would put a statistic to it, oddly more successful than the so-called love marriage. Although I haven't, you know, compared the two with any great study. But what intrigued me and what enchants me about the story of The Namesake partly is the fact of two people who choose each other to marry. They are set up by their families, but they are strangers to each other who then fall in love, you know. And that is a sort of the eros of that idea is very interesting to me. And for me, more than the book does, I very much was very clear that I wanted to rest my adaptation of The Namesake on two basic pillars. You know, one, the exquisite love story of an adult romance of Ashok and Ashima through the years, a romance that... a love story, really, that, like people I know of my parents' generation, who are content to be still, you know, who don't need roses and diamonds and Hallmark cards and I love yous and proclamations or public displays of love. But it's more about how one looks at each other over a cup of tea and the kind of a stillness and contentment between the two, which is in such stark contrast to Gogol's life and to all our lives today, you know, our multitasking sort of lives, which instant gratification kind of reigns supreme, you know. And
was there a period of your life when you didn't have as sympathetic a view toward at least some arranged marriages, when you thought that they were all like a terrible idea and you fully rebelled against it?
Oh, I fully rebelled against it. I was one time I was 18 years old and my mother said that there was a proposal that came in from a big industrialist's family, and she said he'll be at such and such wedding and I want to introduce you. And for that wedding I borrowed my friend's outrageous flouncing gypsy skirt, and I had both my brothers, who are older than me, on either side of either arm, and I you know, strode up to this father-in-law to be and said to him, "Meet my two boyfriends. I have no idea whom to go with tonight." And that settled that, you know. I was no longer a candidate for arranged marriage after that. So I'm completely rebellious against the arranged marriage for myself, you know. But I must say, you know, growing up and seeing the sort of permutations of it and seeing also some of the people who have completely ridden with it, you know, in a beautiful way, it's not as simple as we make it out to be.
What about your parents?
They had an arranged marriage completely and are separated. They're not together for the last, say, 15 years or so. But, you know...
They don't all work.
They don't all work at all. Of course not. But I also know many that have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was your parents' reaction when you pretended that your brothers were your boyfriends?
Oh, they just rolled their eyes and said, "Oh, Meera strikes again." You know, she's my nickname is Pugly, which means the crazy girl. And that was the act of a crazy girl.
Can I ask how you met your husband?
I met my husband in Kampala, Uganda in 1989. I was researching a screenplay on the Asian expulsion from Uganda. And I had read a book that he had written called From Citizen to Refugee. He was a famous writer and academic. And I asked to interview him. And by chance, he had seen Salaam Bombay and loved it and agreed to be interviewed. And so he was one of many people that I was talking to in 1989, when my first visit to the continent, in fact. And I have to say, it was a love at first sight. So 3 months later, we were together forever.
Since you grew up in India and not in Uganda, and your family wasn't part of the expulsion, the Asian expulsion from Uganda, what drew you to Uganda to make a movie about Indians who were forced to leave? Well, and this was the movie Mississippi Masala, and it's in working on that, as you explained, you met your husband.
Well, I... as an Indian student at Harvard, you know, in the late 70s, I was always interested in what I called the hierarchy of color, you know, of being brown in the middle of black and white. Mm-hmm. That I was sort of welcome in both communities, but there were also invisible lines. And I called it in my own way the hierarchy of color. And I wanted to make a film that was about this, about being brown in the midst of black and white. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading totally intellectually and completely, completely in a cool way. I had never been to Africa, leave alone Uganda or the Asian expulsion. I didn't even know about it. But I remember reading about the Asian expulsion, where Idi Amin, you know, threw out a generation of Ugandan Asians who had never known India as their home, who had only known Uganda as their home, based on the color of their skin, largely, and give them 90 days to leave the country. And, you know, these were third generation, often many of them. And how also the trick of history was such that many of these Ugandan Asians came to Mississippi, where they began to buy motels because they were very inexpensive. And also the weirdness was that in Mississippi, it was the birth of the civil rights movement. And I thought to myself, it was a complete fiction. What if, a young girl who has grown up in Uganda, an Asian girl who thinks of herself as African, comes to Mississippi? As history had shown me did happen. And what if she falls in love with an African-American who also, like her, has never known Africa as his home?
My guest is Meera Nair. She directed the new film, The Namesake. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Meera Nair. Her movies include Mississippi Masala, Monsoon Wedding, and Vanity Fair. Her new movie is called The Namesake. In The Namesake, there's a cultural distance between the parents who come to the United States from India after they marry and their children who are born in the United States and are very, very American. They don't have that kind of formality in their relationships with other people that the Indian couple does. And the children's relationship with their parents is different than the children's friends' relationship with their parents. Like there's a nice scene where the son brings his girlfriend over to the house, and when she's introduced to his parents, she kisses them hello, and that's such a forward thing for them. I mean,
and she calls them by their first name.
And she calls them by their first name,
which is a shocking thing for an adult. You never refer in our culture. You never refer to any person who's older than you without a prefix or suffix. You know, an aunt or an uncle or Mrs. or some sign of respect.
So they're just like really they're not mean about it, but they're really just kind of taken aback and like astonished at how familiar she's being with them. And it seems to me you're kind of like culturally probably in the middle of all of this, because you came here when you were how old?
I came here when I was 19.
So you're already pretty formed.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you came here, you know, you're a filmmaker, you're making movies, you're really so connected to people. But your son has grown up in three cultures.
Yes.
In Uganda and India and in the United States. So do you have that kind of like gap with him in terms of him being like more American or more Ugandan or whatever, and of being of a slightly like different culture than you are?
No, I like to think that he isn't. Firstly, he came to this country when he was 8 years old, which is from living entirely in Uganda and then South Africa. And as I mentioned earlier, we live in three generations, whether it's in East Africa or in Manhattan. You know, they're always, his grandparents are with us. And we have a sort of rule that only Hindustani is spoken at home. We don't speak English at home.
Really?
And so he's very fluent in many languages. And he has a different accent for when he leaves the house, I have to say. But he's very interesting about that as well. And because he lives with his with the older generation, there's an enormous dimension to his both his relationship and his solicitous sort of looking after them, which I think is a huge something that the Americans have really cut off from their lives, which is a real lament for me. You know, how much an American family can gain from the presence of an older person with them. You know, it's so much a nuclear family here, so much just your mother, father, and your kid, you know. So Zoran is kind of, and also we live actively in Uganda as well, 3 months a year, and also in India, and it's like monsoon wedding in my house. You know, people are always coming and going from other places, from my brothers, their children, and so on. So he's part of a network, you know, that is, when Zoran goes to India, for instance, his cousins speak less Hindi than he does. You know, they speak English entirely, and he speaks Hindi at home in Manhattan.
You know, your movies, like several of them, do explore kind of like cultural connections, cultural identities. Living in three different cultures, as you do, in three different countries, as you do, Uganda, India, and the United States. As you get a little bit older, does your tie to any one country increase, you know, and as you think about where you want to spend most of your time?
I think that in about a few years, as my son begins to go to college and we are actively thinking of spending more time between Uganda and New Delhi in India. There's so much I want to do. I'm a gardener, for instance, in Uganda, and I'm really possessed by that, and I miss my garden. And I also have a film school in Uganda called Maisha, which is a Swahili word which means life. Every summer, we have a kind of boot camp for cinema where we give about 24 fellowships to students from Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda, as well as India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. And we bring in mentors, great screenwriters and great directors from everywhere, from Bollywood to Nigeria to Los Angeles to London. And they come together, much like a Sundance Lab here. We have a school because I believe that if we don't tell our own stories, no one else will tell them. And the Africa that we see on our screens is rarely made by an African. And so I'm very, involved with Maisha, and we want to build a center for it and so on. So it's a longer term dream that keeps me coming back, you know.
Did you grow up watching a lot of Bollywood films? And no?
Not at all. I grew up in a one-horse town, a tiny town with one Bhubaneswar, with one film theater, which consistently and forever showed Dr. Zhivago. And I had no interest or no you know, idea that a film as a could be an interesting or important medium. You know, even Satyajit Ray's movies were unknown in India at that time. They were just not shown beyond Calcutta, in fact. And I saw an occasional Bollywood movie, but nothing I took desperately seriously. I mean, I would swoon over some of the romantic love songs, but the movies were not to be taken seriously, you know. My interest was political theater and street theater, which is what I got involved with in Calcutta, for instance, when I was 15. And I pursued that, you know, that was what I came to this country for, in fact, is to pursue, you know, engage theater, and arrived at Harvard on a scholarship. And the theater was, you know, Oklahoma, hoop skirts and musicals, and had nothing to do with changing the world, you know. And so I had to choose something else that this university could give me. And through taking a course in photography, stumbled into documentary filmmaking, which was a great blessing because at an age of like 20, 21, I had found my place in the world.
Making fiction films now, has it given you more respect for the hoop skirt musicals like Oklahoma?
Actually, Oklahoma came back to haunt me because my son Zoran was cast as the lead, Curly, in his school play of Oklahoma. So I, you know, wake up singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," and it's hilarious. That is the same play that drove me out of the theater is now what I'm living with. But well, yeah, I mean, making narrative film, one has greater respect for so many things.
Well, Mira Nair, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Mira Nair directed the new film, The Namesake. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting Fast Food Nation, starring Greg Kinnear, who learns the truth about the all-American industry, now on DVD. And from Debbie and Norris Bishton, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Give us your blessings. Please don't make us run away.
The lead singer of the Shangri-Las has returned to music after nearly four decades. Mary Wyse's first solo album has just been released. Coming up, we talk with her. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
When I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V.
That's one of the hits that the great girl group the Shangri-Las had in the 60s. Some of the other hits were Leader of the Pack, Remember Walking in the Sand, Give Us Your Blessings, and Long Live Our Love. The Shangri-Las had a tough urban image and sang songs about teenage love that often ended in tragedy. Some of their records were produced like mini-dramas with dialogue and sound effects. The group originally consisted of sisters Mary and Betty Weiss and twin sisters Marge and Marianne Ganser. The lead singer, my guest Mary Weiss, left music after the group broke up in the late 60s, but now she's returned with her first solo album called Dangerous Game. Weiss's new CD was described in The New Yorker as a remarkable solo debut. Quote, Weiss is in fine voice, and the songs combine the dark innocence of girl group records with a mature sense of regret. Here's the opening track from Mary Weiss's new CD, Dangerous Game. The song is called My Heart is Beating.
When you held me close, that's when I knew, shook me through and through. I couldn't let you go. I couldn't let it show. And this whole world's unfair. I know it's true. What can I do? One day you'll be free. You'll come running to me. Till then, my heart beating, beating, baby. I know you've been cheating, but if I take you back, you gotta walk a straight and narrow track. I said, if I take you back,
that's Mary Weiss from her new CD, Dangerous Game. Mary Weiss, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you recording again.
Thank you.
Yeah, you really sound great on the new record, but you haven't recorded and you haven't even performed much since the Shangri-Las broke up in the late 60s. Why have you stayed away from music for so many years?
Basically, when we first started, it was all about music. And by the time we finished, it was all about litigation. And it just became thicker than the music.
So you'd become very disillusioned with the whole music business?
I'd say that.
So what changed? And did somebody convince you to come back now?
Interestingly enough, I was listening to an interview you did with Iggy Pop.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned life being in 7-year cycles. And I was just floored because I've always viewed life that way. And I've had a lot of things happen to me in recent years. I lost my mom, I lost my brother, and I've been reevaluating what it is I want to do with the last sector of my work life.
And why did you think you wanted to go back to music?
Because music is home to me, it always was. Music was my life as a child growing up, and it got me through most of the things in my life. And it feels like where I belong, so...
So it must have been horrible to not be able to perform for all those years.
I've never been real fond of performing live. I'm a very private person, but I love the studio. That's my home.
So that must have been frustrating, not being able to record.
Yes and no. When I put something down, I really put it down. And I packed my bags and I went on my way. I developed a new career. I was working for an architectural firm, and I had started in their accounting department. By the time I left, I was their chief purchasing agent, and I worked at commercial furniture dealerships, and I installed multimillion-dollar installations.
Did they know who you were?
Yeah, unfortunately. sometimes people would show up at my place of employment with an album in hand.
So through those years, when you weren't recording, were you singing at home?
No, not really.
Not even just for pleasure?
No. I know it sounds weird.
In the new record, it seems to me like you have some connection to the Shangri-La sound without trying to mimic that sound. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of sound you wanted to have on your new CD?
I was hoping to sound like an adult me, which is kind of a given. When I listen to some of my old records, I can't believe how nasally I sounded. But I was a child, so that's understandable. But I wanted to make a straight-up rock and roll record, and I think we achieved that without going too far off base from my roots.
How did you find new songs that you liked?
It was quite difficult. Initially, everybody kept sending me death records, death songs. Everybody was dying off left and right.
Because so many, in the melodramas of the Shangri-La song, so many people died.
Right, which is fine as a teenager, and I could relate to it as a teenager, but we have enough of that in life.
Let's talk a little bit about the Shangri-Las. Now, you started out in high school performing at local bars with the Shangri-Las before you started recording. And the band was initially made up of you, your sister Betty, and two twins who were your friends.
Right.
What was the band like before you started recording?
Well, actually, we met in grammar school. The neighborhood I grew up in, there were maybe 300 kids around the same age or in the same age bracket. And we used to sing on the street corner, all of us. So that's how we really started. And not bars. I was too young to be in a bar, actually.
Right.
Little hops and dances and things like that we did initially until we went up to Bob Lewis's apartment and met Shadow Morton.
And the story of how you met George Shadow Morton, who became one of your producers and one of your chief songwriters, is a story that's kind of entered rock and roll lore. But I want you to tell it.
We had an original manager. I believe his name was Tony Michaels. And he wanted Bob Lewis to hear us singing. So he had made an appointment with him, and we went up to his apartment just to hear us, and we got up and sang for him a cappella. And George was there, Shadow, sitting there, and that's when I met him.
And he, I think, wrote this on a dare. He was trying to convince the songwriter, Jeff Barry, that he was really a songwriter, and he could write, you know, a ballad or an up-tempo tune. And so the way the story goes, as I've heard it, is that he wrote this song as a dare on a dare to prove to Jeff Barry that he could do it, and then asked the Shangri-Las to record it, and the song was "Remember Walking in the Sand," which is one of those great drama songs that you
I really
recorded.
Like that record.
Oh, I love the record. I mean, who doesn't?
I'm doing that on stage.
Are you?
Yes, I am.
Oh, what was your first reaction? It was so unlike other songs,
I love the song from the first time I heard it, and we went into a studio, I believe it was in Long Island, and laid it down on demo and then brought it up to Redbird.
Redbird Records. So, let's hear Remember, which was the Shangri-La's first hit, and you were, what, 15 when this was recorded?
I believe so.
Okay, here we go. That's the Shangri-Las, their first hit. My guest Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, and now she has a new solo CD, which is called Dangerous Game. Now, this song has such drama to it, you know, like when you're saying, like, let me think, what can I do? Were you used to that kind of drama in your performances?
I was used to that kind of drama in my life, so I think it would come out in my performances.
What kind of drama in your life?
Well, I think teenagers, for the most part, I can only speak for myself, but teenagers have an intensity that we seem to, I don't think we grow out of, but there's variable shades of gray added where when you're a teen, a lot of things, or for me anyway, everything was black and white. I don't know if I'm expressing myself correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us like an example of a dramatic incident that had already happened to you when you were 15 and recorded this?
Not specifically. It's just the way I grew up with a difficult childhood.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up pretty poor, and I mean, I've been supporting myself since I'm 14. So, I don't know. There was a lot of pain in me.
My guest is Mary Weiss. In the 60s, she was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. She has a new solo album called Dangerous Game. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Weiss. In the 60s, she was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. Now she's returned to music with her first solo CD called Dangerous Game. Weiss was only 15 when the Shangri-Las had their first hit, Remember Walking in the Sand. Some people lose their bearings when they have that kind of sudden success at a young age. Did you?
Definitely. I think most... It's hard enough for an adult to deal with that type of situation, much less a child. Sure, I had a lot of problems with that.
In what ways do you feel like you were knocked off balance?
Well, I think most kids have a structured home, a more structured home than I did.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, maybe not. But years ago, I remember people having like two parents and finishing school and, you know, more structure than I did. I grew up on the road. I had a road manager who was barely a couple of years older than me. So, I mean, kids were going to proms and I was giving press conferences in London. It's quite a weird way to grow up.
If you don't mind my asking, did guys in bands try to hit on you on the road when you were traveling in rock and roll shows and sharing a bill?
Other bands?
Yeah.
Sometimes, of course. We have such a tough image, supposedly. But
the Shangri-Las, absolutely, yeah.
I think a lot of that comes from surviving, from making people back down.
Including the guys in the bands that you traveled with.
Sure. Some of them.
So you didn't have a tough image before your success?
I never thought much about image. I just didn't like chiffon dresses and high heels. I'm you know, that's as honest as I can be. And I never liked women's slacks back then. You know, they didn't have low-rise pants?
Mm-hmm.
In 1964. They just didn't make them, so I used to go to a place on 8th Street and have men's clothes tailored for me.
Did anyone ever try, anyone like from a record company ever try to make the Shangri-Las more girlish and glamorous and less kind of tough looking in, you know, your boots and pants?
No, actually not. what we wore on stage after we started making money. I mean, you can see the difference from early on. We didn't have any clothes. Where you saw other groups where they had money and support behind them, were extremely well-dressed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. We were out there pretty much in our street clothes. But then when we started making money, we designed our own clothes and had them made in the village.
Let's hear, but talk about first, another really famous Shangri-La's recording, and I'm thinking of Leader of the Pack.
Okay.
Your first impression of the song when it was presented to you?
I really had to sit down with this one. I took it home and listened to it for a very long time before I agreed to do it.
Why were you so reluctant?
Even at the time, it was pretty much out there. I mean, in England, there was a very rigid environment, even globally. I mean, the record was banned in England the first time it came out.
Did you rehearse this song differently than you usually rehearsed songs because of the spoken parts in it and the drama?
Well, usually I'd rehearse those home initially. And I remember having hard times with certain songs where we'd actually dim lights in the studio so I could feel like alone in order to be able to deliver it properly. The Lookout took a little bit because it's kind of metered and it had to be right on the money to do, so I would just sit at home and yell Lookout. I'm sure my neighbors loved that.
Well, why don't we hear the song? And this
okay.
is the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
Goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
The Shangri-La's. My guest Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the group. She has a new solo CD, her first solo CD, called Dangerous Game. You know, as we were saying, the Shangri-La's had the image of being very tough. What was your neighborhood like in Queens when you were growing up?
I probably would consider it middle to low middle class.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of kids in the neighborhood. an average neighborhood, pretty much.
What did your mother do to support you?
She had periodic jobs on occasion, but nothing really substantial.
Mm-hmm. So you were pretty much scraping by?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it must have been really welcomed when you started making a lot of money.
There you go.
And did you send a lot back to your mother?
Always. Mm-hmm. We kind of raised her as much as we could.
We'll talk more with Mary Weiss after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Weiss. In the 60s, she was the lead singer in the girl group The Shangri-Las. She's just released her first solo album. It's called Dangerous Game. Here's another track from it called Stop and Think It Over. Now, you were on with the Shangri-La shows like Hullabaloo and Shindig. Was it fun to lip-sync on TV to your records?
I never really cared for it. I liked it when you went to... If you look at some of the ones on YouTube, the sync isn't correct, mm-hmm. but I know which ones are actually sung live. Several of them are, mm-hmm. and several are lip-sunk. I mean, if you did a show like Clay Cole or Soupy Sales, obviously you would lip sync.
Yeah, Clay Cole was one of those like dance shows that was shown in New York. I'm not sure if it was national. I know I used to watch it in New York.
Oh, yeah, it was in the WPIX building.
But
the other shows were much larger, and they took a week to do. You'd fly out to L.A., and a lot of them were live. The music might have been pre-recorded, but all of the vocals were live.
What are you hoping for musically and professionally this time around? You'd stayed away from the music business since the late 60s. There was so much litigation. You were so kind of disillusioned with the business at that point. You stayed away for decades. What do you want this time around?
Actually, I want music. The funny thing about it now is I'm not a kid. There is no ladder I'm trying to climb. I have nothing to prove. No one can remove what I've done from my past. It is what it is. And now it's time to just have some music in my life and have some fun. I don't know. The whole thing has been fabulous. And the response is absolutely overwhelming. But I'm not looking for anything specific. I just want to rock and roll. That's how I want to spend my last days before I retire.
Since you didn't sing for so long, and it sounds like you didn't even sing around the house, were you surprised that your voice is still there and still really good?
I wonder if that isn't why.
I mean, sometimes. Like you didn't blow it out on the road.
Well, I mean, everybody that worked back then had their own throat specialists because we didn't have monitors. You couldn't hear anything ever. So everybody's vocal cords were way far extended. To me, monitors are a luxury. I look at them and they're like, I'm amazed. I'm really not looking for anything specific, so that's why it's really about music and just fun.
I'd like to close with another track from your new CD, and since I've been making all the choices, I'm going to ask you to choose one of your favorites.
Break It One More Time. Break It For Me One More Time.
Tell me why you're choosing it.
I just really like the song. I loved doing it, and I just really feel that number.
Okay. Mary Weiss, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the new CD.
Thanks so much.
Mary Weiss was the lead singer of the Shangri-Las. Her new solo CD is called Dangerous Game. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Break It One More Time from Mary Weiss's new CD.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA Cref, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dr. Richard Jaddick received a Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor for his service during the Battle of Fallujah, where he set up aid stations under fire in the middle of the battle. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about practicing combat medicine in urban warfare. Dr. Jaddick has written a memoir called On Call in Hell. Join us for the next Fresh Air.